On the public side?
No, he was a fireman for a while.
I think this guy from UVS is out there?
Yes.
All right, let's...
Let me go grab him?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Yeah, this is the only city hall where there's security to get into the building.
Really?
It's quick process that you have. It's probably a good idea. Now, there's some that has security to get into council chambers.
Right. Well, because council chambers is in our building. That's why we put it in. Well, a lot of counties have security. All federal buildings do, but...
How much does it cost a year?
Our security put around, hold on, $130,000, I think.
$140,000 here, $140,000 there.
Well, I mean, that's security for this building, CSO, and the parking garage.
We need security for our judicial...
We'll put you right here.
Sure, right.
Everybody has...
Courthouse.
Of course, it will never be enough if somebody does.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first thing that they say.
Right. Why do you have security?
First thing they say is, what was your security record?
And prior to that, we go, how can you spend so much? So, you know what? I'd rather expect something and try than not.
That's right.
And have to try to defend that to a breathing game.
So about a 20-minute presentation and maybe 10 minutes for questions?
Terrific. Okay. Quickly. Good morning. Thank you for letting me come here. My name is Tom Anathan. I grew up in Ohio in a town about this size, although the town now is a lot smaller than even Ocala is. And I'm not exactly the first person to have done this. I'm now a resident of Florida. I drove up last night. I'm down in the southeast near Stewart. And I'm pleased to report that I had no obstructions coming up, but boy, going south was a real problem yesterday, so I'm glad I was coming up to visit. I am delighted to be here. You've been a client.
He's one of the thousand you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about population flux.
Well, one of the things we look at, I mean, obviously, one of the things that drives real estate is people and the economy. And when we became residents of Florida a number of years ago, Florida was the fourth largest state. And approximately 6 months ago, Florida overtook the state of New York to become the third most populous state. It now has close to 20 million people. New York is sort of plateaued somewhere around 19.3, 19.4 million. Next largest state is Texas with around 23 million. And then California is the granddaddy with 37 million. So this state is doing very well. Just generally, we like Florida a lot. And in your portfolio, there are a number of apartment investments, particularly along the southeast. We also own there's a Hyatt Regency very close to the Tampa Airport that's in this portfolio and an office building next to it. We've not been as active an office investor in this market. Offices have a little bit higher volatility. We also have in your portfolio, 1.1 million square feet of industrial in Weston, which is due west of Fort Lauderdale. We like the state a lot. But at any rate, let me jump into the portfolio. I am glad to be here, particularly as Rosemary knows, the alternative of being up north, it's not pretty today. It's we're having a record cold. Let me see if I can cover a lot of the things that Rosemary wanted. By the way, it turns out Rosemary and I go back a number of years, so and being the gentleman, we won't talk about how many. I'm going to jump to page 5, and I'm going to really try and go quickly to get through everything. Our organization, and I'm not going to cover the global because we operate as a separate entity in the United States. So our organization formed as part of Aetna in 1978, so we're coming up on our 40th anniversary of being in business. We started with the Trumbull Property Fund. It was called something else then, but it was the Trumbull Property Fund. And that's the fund you're in. And it is our flagship fund with $23 billion in assets. So the entire organization has $32 billion in assets. And if you talked to me a year ago, it would have been about $28, $29 billion. We have 218 employees. If you had talked to me a year or so ago, the number would have been 195. We continue to invest in our business. by adding staff appropriately to reflect the growth in assets, strong relationships and properties and people. Looking at page six, just quickly, an overview. This is not your fund. This is our overall organization in the United States, but it gives you some exposure to it. So broad diversification by property types. One of our features that's a little different is that we've been an apartment investor for 30 years. We like apartments. They're doing well. The trends are, I'm hearing Rosemary's admonition about 20 minutes. Apartments are doing well. I'll go on to the next thing. But people aren't buying homes the way they used to. Particularly people my kids' age, which are in their 30s and 40s. And part of that is economic, but part of it is strategic for flexibility reasons. People don't work for the same employers in many instances for 30 or 40 years anymore, and they know they may have.
Quick question, are any Florida markets being overbuilt? In your opinion?
Yeah, you know, it's all local. I mean, clearly, I mean, Miami is sort of the poster child for boom bust, and particularly in condos, but not as much multifamily, and it's overbuilt, period, full stop. In rental apartments, it's in pretty good shape, and we have a couple of apartments in Miami that have been doing well. The balance of it is pretty much in balance despite the fact there's been a lot of construction. And the reason that people are surprised that it's still in balance is because demand is stronger than people are forecasting. And so let me keep moving, because I'm, as Rosemary probably knows, I will go on forever, and that's not part of my job assignment. Page seven, the multidisciplinary organization. There are only three or four points I want to take home from here. If you look at where the headcount is, you look at what we do. The headcount is in asset management. The headcount is accounting. If you manage each property intensively, if you have, if you want to account for it and be able to do performance attribution, that's where the headcount should be. In terms of organizational change, one of the questions asked by Rosemary, not significant at all. There have been what I would call a couple of refinements. The property sales team used to report to asset management. They now coordinate with acquisitions. That makes more sense in terms of both market feedback and allocation of work. We've added some to the Trumbull Property Fund portfolio team, and those would be the primary things. Page eight, senior investment professionals. The names don't mean anything to you here. What's important is 33 years of industry experience, and 28 years on the investment committee. And the investment committee averages 25 years with UBS Realty. Enormous stability within the organization. Page nine are some of the strengths that we have over the years that clients have told us about. But again, in deference to time, I'm going to keep moving. And I think page 11 is important and maybe worth spending a second, because the hallmark of this fund is a very high quality fund with very strong assets, institutional in nature, and relatively unleveraged. And so the point of this portfolio is, it is what it's intended to be, a very high quality core portfolio. And if you look at Liberty Lux, Liberty Green, for example, in the upper left-hand corner, it's done with the Rose family out of New York. It's right across from Goldman Sachs' new headquarters. And the rent for the penthouse, if it was available, is only $27,500 a month. So it's a very, it's, yeah, exactly.
Is that all?
Which month would I like? Yeah. 455 Market is a premier office property in San Francisco, older, but we developed it back in the early 90s, and so forth across the way. Water Tower Place in Chicago is 800 North Michigan Avenue, a very, very high quality investment. So. Page 12 provides superior risk-adjusted returns. I think there are a number of points I would make in this, but one, we're intended to be the high-quality, low-risk portfolio, and we undertake that in a number of different ways. We have a very strong focus when we buy properties on income, and that's really important to us. What's not on this chart is something that I think is also critically important, and that is we have an enormously detailed acquisition process, multi-discipline. So that when we buy a property, it includes not only the acquisition officer, who's usually somewhat optimistic about the property, but the asset manager, who is going to be the person who inherits that property after it's acquired. And that adds a little bit of counterbalance to it, because the asset manager's bonus in the next year is predicated on achieving performance. So there's some built-in dialectic and tension on it, and that's the way it should be. Page 13, this is our portfolio management team for the Trumbull Property Fund that you're invested in. And I would only say in the what's different from 2 years ago on page 13, the what's different is that there are two more names here than were a year or two ago. So again, we continue to add people to the staff as for responsiveness of the portfolio. Page 14, I guess I'd really direct you over at this point to the fund highlights. 39-year track record, we're coming up on 40 years shortly. $23 billion in total assets, around $20 billion in equity. Gross return for almost 40 years of 9%. And I will tell you, we had a client, a small aircraft manufacturer based in Seattle. And I probably shouldn't mention Boeing's name, so I won't. But they put $45 million into the Trumbull Property Fund in 1979 and didn't touch it. And last year, that was worth $700 million. So 9% compound annual, just put it in and let us work real hard and do not worry too much. Worked out pretty well for them. I probably shouldn't say it. If that was a matter of public record, please scratch Boeing's name. And 216 investments. So I guess I'm going to focus on income. I'm going to go down the line that says income focus. I mentioned that strong diversification, low leverage. We do some value added, as it turns out, a little bit less in the industry, but we do some value added. And in the real estate business, we worry about something called sustainability. And sustainability is what can we do in a cost-efficient way to be responsive to the environment. We don't do it just to do it. We do it when there's a reasonable return on investment. So looking up at the lights here, for example, an easy one is get rid of the incandescent lights and put in fluorescent. And that usually has about an 8-month payback. So that's a simple one, but then you can look into the energy efficiency of the operations and the sort of bridge too far that doesn't have the payback yet is solar. Because a great deal of the solar benefits are related to tax credits and being tax exempt, we can't use that. So solar is what we're looking at but haven't implemented yet. But other energy efficiencies, and I'll show you later on, we've received awards for where the Trumbull Property Fund is. Again, in deference to time, I'm going to skip portions of it. But let me, on page 15, property type allocation. If you look at the current Trumbull Property Fund allocation, and look at Odyssey, which is a frequent benchmark for the Trumbull Property Fund. The primary differences between where we are and where Odyssey is in multifamily, where we're at 31%, where Odyssey is at 24%. In office, where we're at 31%, and Odyssey is at 37%. I like those allocations. I'm comfortable with that. The very quick rationale of what we use to benchmark ourselves in terms of property type allocation, it's not Odyssey. It's a much larger universe. It's the institutional universe of commercial real estate. Because if you want to be on or near what they call the efficient frontier, what you do is you want to roughly allocate in relationship to the global, to the US market. And so that's what we've done, and that, therefore, our allocation is a little bit different than Odyssey, but in fact, it is more efficient, and I'll show you that in the performance shortly. Let's jump down to page 16. I've got to get new eyeglasses. The 10 largest markets and assets. I think this is important for a number of reasons. First of all, this shows you where your major assets are. You can see Boston, Dallas, New York, Chicago, the gross market value. One point I would say is no single asset is more than 3% of the overall portfolio. That's good. You don't want to have too big a portfolio concentration. The second is that when you add up the 10 largest assets, I think that's 10, yeah, largest assets, it represents 25% of the portfolio, so there remains good diversification. If you look at the markets by fund, it's where everybody else wants to be. It's the major growth markets, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, Boston, the so-called gateway markets. So that, and you add those markets up, and it represents almost 75% of the portfolio. Page 17, TPF positioning. Where are we in terms of the environment, mature economy? We're all recognizing that the economy has been in 9 years of recovery or 9 years of growth, and it's beginning to show in the core portfolios, the core returns. Out of Odyssey and all the major funds have been double digit. It's now down to mid to high single digits. Slowing net operating income growth, but I think an important point to recognize is net income growth remains positive. And I'll probably mention this later somewhere. We've done a 3-year pro forma and expect net operating income to grow about 8% a year for the next 3 years. So we are seeing growth as well. I would say I'm going to talk, I'm not going to spend any more activity on this page. Page 18, acquisition activity. What we're doing, I'm on page 18, and what are we buying? The first is an industrial, in the first and third actually are industrial. The way we are accessing industrial properties, and this has been a strong performer for us and for the portfolio, is through joint ventures with operating partners. And Lakeview in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, is with a developer by the name of CenterPoint, with whom we've had a 20-year relationship. The Becknell is a relationship that we've had going back almost 30 years. And it's those relationships enable us to get in many instances, and develop industrial, lease it up, and then, as appropriate, move it out. We also are doing an 8 medical office building complex in Long Island, adjacent to a hospital, and very, very well leased. Let me spend 1 second on page 19, which is value added. A couple of things. In the core portfolios, most of them are 5 to 15% in value added investments. When we do value added, almost invariably, it's in the multifamily space or in the industrial space. And those are two areas that are, for us, areas of expertise. They are areas where we believe that development makes a lot of sense. We lay off a great deal of the risk to others so that when we enter into them, the land is all fully entitled and ready to go. So the developer basically brings to us a buildable site that's ready to go. And that strategy has worked very well for the fund. And industrial is largely the same, and you can see that roughly 75% or 3/4 of our value added are in those, roughly 90% of that value added activity is in those two areas. Page 20, I want to spend 1 second on this, because this is really important. We have a history of being pretty efficient and effective in selling properties. And people don't realize, you know, one of our jobs is to buy them well and manage them well, but it's also to sell them when they should be sold. And in 2015, we sold almost $1 billion of real estate out of this portfolio. In 2016, the number dropped down just because of the way sales fell. But that number was low, it was in the $300 or $400 million range. And in 2017, this year, the number is expected to be over $1 billion again. So we are actively reviewing the portfolio. Sales generally fall into one of three or four types, where opportunistically the market gets hot and someone offers us a lot more money than we think the property is worth. Strategically, we decide we have too much multifamily in Dallas, and we start selling off some multifamily in Dallas because we don't want to be overweighted there. And the third is tactically, where we look at our investment and say, you know, this investment is tired. The market is not that great. Sometimes when it's tired, we'll reinvest and make it new. And sometimes we'll say, let's give somebody else the opportunity to reinvest and make it new. So those are the three broad categories. If you look at these sample dispositions, Riverside Plaza, and there's a long story here, but we really executed that beautifully. That was a property with an empty anchor that we got fully leased and moved out. And the property in Bellingham was simply an older property in a mature market. And the same with the St. Paul Business Center. The Wellington and Laguna Hill, I'm really sorry to see go. It was a congregate care facility near the Ritz-Carlton and Laguna Niguel. I had reserved a suite there for myself, but they sold it, so there goes that suite.
So what is the typical turnover rate? So you buy a property, you're holding it 10 years, you're holding it 3 years. What's the average hold period?
Yeah, I would say the average, remembering that this is a core portfolio, so in our value-added fund, open-end value-added fund, the average hold is 3 to 4 years. In this fund, on average, it's 10 years. But some of them you're going to hold longer than that. I mean, if you get a premier property, we own, for example, in Boston, the Cambridge Side Galleria. It was Steve Carpet, New England Development. We were in the development team on that in 1989. It's essentially a regional mall in downtown Cambridge. And the closest competitive mall was the Burlington Mall, then you've got Chestnut Hill. And so there are assets that would we sell them? Yeah, but we think long and hard about it. Because at the end of the day, those are the sort of premier assets that you were saying, if you owned them personally, would you like to give it to your grandchild? Yes. And if the answer to that is yes, you think long and hard about it. On the other hand,
is the whole period different via property type? Like, do you have a different hold period for industrial versus apartments?
I was going to say that for apartments, you don't fall in love with them quite as much, and so those tend to have a 7 to 8 year holding period.
You think that way for malls? I'm thinking malls are starting to go to the wayside. You know?
Well, they are. And retailing is retailing, how many hours do you have? Retailing is really interesting, and it's what's going on right now. I mean, clearly Amazon and Walmart are factors. Bricks and mortar growth have gone from 5 or 6% to 10 to 11% of retail sales. What's happening with retailing is, well, let me address it. I'll just give you two quick bites, sound bites. The first is the buzzword now is experiential. You don't want to have a mall that just has stores. You want to have a mall where something is going on. I mean, the joke about malls now is it's a place where you can get your hair done, you can have dinner, you can go to a movie, and you can have a colonoscopy, but not necessarily in that order. But what they wanted is they want you to have what we need to have is something going on there, more than just going in and buying something. And that's, so you're seeing sort of transformation into active town centers. So that is being driven by Amazon. what is not being driven by Amazon is there are a lot of centers that would have failed in any event. And the reason is that they're sort of middle of the road, they don't have value, they're not a TJ Maxx on the one hand, and a Tiffany's on the other, they're somewhere in between. And that type of mall could have a lot of struggling over the next 5 years. So absolutely, there's a lot going on in retailing right now. This is the irony of it. When you look at a 1, 3, and 5 year return out of the NCREIF property index by property type, the top performing sector was retail. And the reason is in part because it didn't have the appreciation before, so it's sort of a lag catch up. But those that are left are doing pretty well. And so, for example, one of the properties I showed at your beginning, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to spend any time in Chicago on North Michigan Avenue, but Water Tower Place is a vertical mall on North Michigan Avenue. And it's retail, and B, vertical malls are hard to lease because it's tough to get people to go to the 8th floor. And it's doing just fine, thank you. But it also is adding in the, you know, doctor's offices and movie theaters and everything else, so that, and restaurants, so that people wanna go there.
Now, talk a little bit about your, and I think it's in here, so I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, the difference between you and the Odyssey, and you've lagged the Odyssey,
yeah,
obviously, for specific reasons.
Yeah.
So just,
yeah,
talk a little bit about what the benchmark is versus what you are and sort of why,
right,
there's some differences,
right,
there in this current
market. Let me step back and say the easiest analogy, is that this is a AAA bond fund in a BAA universe. And what does that mean? That means when the market is doing well, it will underperform, and when the market is not doing well, it is expected to overperform. In 2009, the Trumbull Property Fund outperformed Odyssey, which is a benchmark, by 700 basis points. And on a rolling 10-year basis, meaning 10 years ending March 31st, 1988, 10 years ending June 30th, 1988, rolling 10 years going like that, it's outperformed Odyssey 82% of the time. The nature of this fund is it's very high quality, and it's less leverage than Odyssey. And in some instances, it's been less leveraged by 50% than Odyssey. And so this is an environment where, frankly, it's going to struggle a little bit because primarily due to the leverage. But on the other hand, I was just with, not going to mention any more client names, one, a very, very, very large state fund, probably number 4 or 5 in the country, who has a multi-billion dollar real estate portfolio and is invested in this fund. And I was just with them last week at a NCREIF meeting. I'm still involved with NCREIF. And the woman turned to me and said, "We know exactly what you're doing. We're happy with it. We've been a 30-year investor, and we're going to be with you for another 30 years. So the clients, in the short run, if you look at it, you say, what's wrong? The answer is there's nothing wrong. It's a strategic difference. But Rosemary's question is really good, because if you underperform, it either can be you're doing something wrong or there's a slight strategic difference. The slight strategic difference, because of the length of the above market, above average appreciation, stands out more than it has historically. But the portfolio is 92% leased. It has a higher income return than Odyssey. It's just primarily the performance challenges from lower leverage. Nobody wants the markets to turn down, but we're 9 years into an economic recovery, and we all know trees don't grow to the sky. And so at some point, you'll feel really good about this portfolio again.
And one last question, and
board have some questions. Just talk a little bit about real estate in general being overheated.
Yeah.
Because some of the questions there, yeah. Markets are oversold. I mean, a lot of people, the bond market is not going to give people what they used to. A lot of people feed into real estate, especially poor real estate, to get the income component only.
Right.
And they don't really care much else, right?
Right.
I mean, they just want to clip a coupon, right? Yeah. And so real estate's a way to clip a coupon. So we've had a lot of money running into real estate.
Right.
How does that affect you? How does that affect what you're buying and being able to find things to buy?
Yeah, all good questions. Sort of starting at the macro first, the real estate markets in general across the U.S. Are not in bad shape. And the key metrics we look at are percentage leased and the income return. Pricing has changed in response to a 10-year treasury that this morning was 2.37. Okay, and if I came to you and said over the last 10 years the 10-year treasury went from 4.5 to 2.37 and pricing didn't change in the real estate market, you'd look at me and say, what? And so it has changed in response to that. Interestingly, two things. One, should the 10-year benchmark treasury rates start to go up? It's somewhat indeterminate how that impacts real estate. And the reason I say that is because if rates are going up because the economy is improving, we'll capture that in your portfolio. And so that will be reflected. If rates are going up for unrelated spikes of inflation, an oil embargo, something of that sort, that'll be more difficult for the stock market to handle, the bond market to handle, and the real estate market. When the market turned down in 2007-08, it wasn't because of the real estate industry. The markets were well leased. It was because corporate America suddenly went away in terms of office buildings that were very well leased. Suddenly corporations no longer were leasing or downsizing or what have you. And I'd say in terms of the market today, we're well leased. But in response to what you're saying, what are we doing strategically now? We're selling hotels. This portfolio does not have a lot in the way of hotels, but we're selling hotels. The other property type sector that's really responsive to the U.S. economy is offices, and we are both selling office buildings and making strategic efforts to lease up the others and get them leased now. We continue to like multifamily, and if the economy turns down, apartments will be more important because people won't be buying houses. We continue to like industrial. Walmart has taken, God, I saw the statistics, it was some incredible number, like 70 million square feet of warehouse space last year. And they will do things, and particularly in this market, because Florida is growing so much. And I'll use Hartford, Connecticut as an example. Near the main airport at Hartford in Enfield, they built a 1.1 million square foot distribution center. And then 40 miles south of that in Wallingford, Connecticut, which is where near New Haven, Connecticut, they built a 250,000 square foot, what they call a fulfillment center. So it gets into the big warehouse, goes to the fulfillment centers that are closer to the population districts. So industrial continues to do very well. I mean, the reality is the consumer is still buying. It's just they're just not buying in shopping centers, but the consumer is still buying. And so what we're losing on the one hand is retail clerks, and gaining on the other hand workers in warehouse spaces.
Well, double-edged sword, I saw this morning where Walmart's trying to lower their local store prices to try to get foot traffic in now.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, I mean, and I'm a product of the other direction. If it can be drop shipped to my door, mm-hmm. I'm on it.
Yeah.
I get irritated every time I gotta go somewhere. I get something. I'm like, why is this egg not delivered to my house?
How do you buy a product that you never get to touch and feel?
Yeah.
I guess I'm old school there, you know. I gotta look at it. Just ship it back out, right?
Yep. Nope. I don't want that. I mean, literally, The only thing I ever go to the store for is perishables. And if I could get somebody to drop it at my house. Well, not in Bushnell. Maybe in Chicago, but not in Bushnell. They're not delivering.
So it's where you live, but even here, local now, Publix, if you order over $35, they'll deliver to you.
Right. But of course, I guess I could have it delivered to work if I just don't know.
A new refrigerator showing up in your office.
I have ordered my couch, bedroom set, pictures online sent to my house. Absolutely.
I gotta touch and feel it. I guess, you know, I'm just old school.
The only thing I'm that way with is books. I can't do an e-reader. I'm tactile. I have more books than any one person should own, but I need to have a book. But everything else, drop it to my door. I'm good to go. I'm part of the problem.
No, it is what it is.
I can't get a job retail now to learn how to cash in, because, you know, I'm shopping online.
On that note. Let me finish where I started, because Rosemary is really, as you'd expect, hit the key questions in terms of performance and so forth. Is there anything else in terms of questions that you might have?
It looks like our return is in 7.25%.
Right, exactly.
Compound end. And the reason it's not higher is because it captures the downturn in 2008 and 9. And so there's a dip there that doesn't show. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's sort of where you know, 7, 8, 9 is what unleveraged real estate should be giving you today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would challenge you. You said you have a 3 to 4 year cycle, and now we're 2 cycles beyond 08. It's like, how long are people going to keep on using 08?
It's rolling off, right?
Well, in my mind, 08's in the past, right?
Yes.
Of course,
yes.
What I just said's in the past, too. But
right.
It's like, how long can you keep on using 08 as an excuse for lower than expected returns?
Yeah, I don't know. Let me say yes, sir, and no, sir. I mean, you're right in one sense, although if you go over to one of the other charts, your five-year return was 9.6%. But the other thing is, I was involved when this industry was starting, and probably through more good luck than good planning, we said, you know, at the end of the day, this is somewhere between a bond and a stock. And the bonds, long term, have given 250 basis points real return, and equities have been 700 to 800 basis points real return. And since this is a blend of the two, why don't we say that unleveraged long-term real estate should generate about 500 basis points real return? I haven't cranked it off, but I would bet 7.25 is probably about 500 basis points real return. So in fact, we're giving you what we promised. We wish it were more. We'd love to give you, you know. And we have other strategies that are higher return strategies. But you need to think about what you want to do in a context. And if you want to add a little bit to we have a value-added open-end fund that returned 17% over the last 5 years. But it's 50% leverage. So it's a very different risk profile.
Yeah.
And when the markets turn down, it will be a very different risk profile.
And I think the 08 argument is valid only in context, because we've not had a normal market since 08. I mean, the Fed's buying the securities in massive amounts, bailouts to the big industries, you know, the unemployment, you know, of course, with that I call it a faux low unemployment number, because really people are still underemployed. So they might be employed, but they're underemployed. They're not employed in the same capacity in which they were. Their earning power isn't the same. So even though we, you know, a recovery doesn't go for 9 years. We keep calling it recovering, you know. The economy is so propped up in so many artificial ways that I guess you have to factor 08 in, because all of these things
change.
I think the numbers skew too for the unemployed. I think there's so many that just gave up. They're no longer counted as unemployed.
Yes, and then those that are employed, they're underemployed. They're either working part-time or they're working for less than. You know, benefit structures were changed. I mean, we did a lot of benefit restructuring here. You know, the help, and then, you know, inflation, saying there's no inflation. Well, if you've bought groceries or gas, I call foolishness on there's no inflation. But it's all in how we cook those statistics to make it work one way or the other. So it, and all of that factors in because our economic models are based on normal, sound fiscal and monetary policy, which we've lost our ever-loving minds,
right.
You know, with trillions of dollars in national debt, and always looking for a way to gerrymander that figure, you know, with extenuating measures to keep moving the debt ceiling. I mean, it just, so I don't, I mean, normalcy is just not, I don't even know what that is anymore. Like, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. It's just
one statistic, the Economist, excuse me, have something called U6.
Yes,
and U6,
I look at the U6. Mm-hmm.
And that captures a lot of what you're talking about. And I think that number is 8.8 or something like that.
And
what U6 captures is people have given up and are no longer looking for employment. So the real unemployment number is not, what did they say, 4.2 or something.
Right.
And when you add in that and underemployed and everything, the number's over 8. Mm-hmm.
So we tell, you know, kind of artificial numbers, I think, to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, it's going so great. You know, wages are flat. You know, I mean, if you run out the numbers, you know, wage increases haven't happened, but, you know, the cost of goods and services has.
Sure.
So that disposable income or the buying power of those employed is reduced. That's just, it's not yours.
Good conversations. Any questions, Al?
I think we're good.
All right, great.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much.
For letting me come down. You ought to try going to a store sometime. It'll be okay. I promise you.
I do have a teenager, so I take her to the mall often.
Okay.
That's what teenagers do. They do want to. They want to socialize. They want to try stuff on and walk around the mall. So
they
I
want to touch
know.
It. Like, yeah.
Well,
I mean, for as much as she orders online, she, you know, I take her to the mall almost on a weekly basis. So.
Man, it's misery. I hate going to the mall,
but I drink coffee and read one of those books that I have.
But as you know, all manufacturers, the sizes aren't identical.
Right,
so
you can try stuff on. These clothes are more difficult to buy online.
So how do you do returns? You just leave a package at the door and somebody picks it up?
It depends on the carrier. I mean, some of them, yes. Some of them, you drop it. Some of them, you don't come get it. So it
still less than...
Absolutely.
Going to deal with, especially now, I mean, parking spots are getting harder and harder in the malls.
I think they cause problems here. You'll never get your meeting back.
We're pretty good.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'll invite you back often.
Well, Rose, it's all you now.
It's all me. Okay, so we talked a lot about the economy, so I won't do too much of that, but under tab one, page one, we'll go over what happened in the third quarter. World equity markets were positive, continued optimism about the U.S. economy, and more signs of political stability in Europe. So you can see that world equities were up 4.8%. That's that far left there, the light green. The dark green is for the one-year trailing period through 9/30. U.S. equities was up 4.6. International, again, beat U.S. equities for the second quarter in a row here, 5.4%. And emerging markets, again, big winner here. You added that to your portfolio. Again, remember, it was sort of off to a slow start there for a while. Really picked up, and it's good that you have that dedicated emerging markets exposure there, up 7.9%, and trailing 12 months, 22% there. U.S. fixed income positive for the quarter. Not really, you know, not huge expectations out of fixed income, but you see some positive gain there. And then international fixed income positive, commodities positive for the quarter, though negative on the trailing one-year period. International fixed and commodities, you can see there. We had a weaker U.S. dollar And so that helps some of the international markets there. Real estate, that's a little bit a lag there, but up 7% for the 1 year. Private equity, that's a lag there a little bit too, but up 12% there. And then hedge funds doing okay. You can see the numbers on page 2 if you want, you know, as opposed to looking at that chart there, see the numbers. And you can see commodities year-to-date negative and across the board negative there. So any equities that you had that were sort of linked to commodities, you might have had some weakness there. But other than that, equities has just been on a very long run here. You can see those 5-year numbers. And the 10-year numbers there do factor in 08, so it's a little muted there. But once 08 drops off, you're going to see these very strong numbers, which is people are talking about this 9-year recovery. And so, you know, might see some pullback at that at some point. You know, the charts in here, that, you know, they are the same with GDP, labor force participation, all the same charts that we put in here. You know, from quarter to quarter, I'm not going to go through those in detail. Again, you know, we like to put those statistics in there so you can see them from quarter to quarter and what changes. We do put our noteworthy developments in here, which do change from quarter to quarter, pages 17, 18, and 19. And I just highlight that. There is a webinar. I hope you all are getting invited to that webinar. If you're not, let me know and I can make sure that your email's on the list. But our research group will go over these with you in very detailed on the webinar on a quarterly basis. But page 17 here, really talking about PE, right? PE is usually a predictor of forward 10-year equity returns, right? So they take the historical PE and then they look at forward, strong predictor of forward 10-year equity returns, right? And so not great, you know, when you look at that, it's basically predicting S&P to be 5% for the next 10 years going forward. Right, and that's not what we've seen, right? We've seen a lot higher returns. So that sort of tells you why people keep saying there's going to be a correction and there's going to be something going on, because when you look at these kind of PE rates, you're like, that's not really supported, right? And so that's just, we just sort of tell people that, is we really want that a backdrop for people when they're really thinking about equities and what your returns are and what your expectations. You've lowered your return a lot. Not all boards have lowered their return expectations forward-looking, and so that's important. Page 18 talks about volatility. We talked a little bit about this here. We're at basically record low volatility, and so a lot of managers will tell you as an active manager that it's very difficult to be active in such a low volatility world. It tends to favor passive management. And then, you know, it just really goes through here why maybe that volatility number is as low as it is. And I think some of the things that you talked about, where you were talking about the measures of unemployment and other things, so you know, it's like the economy's weak, but you've got this stable economic data saying that it's really not, right? So you've got these sort of conflicting things there, and that's maybe causing some of that. And then page 19 just really talk about the correlation between this is interest rate movements and value stocks, right? And so that's sort of just an interesting chart there, because you really don't think about the correlations between fixed income and equities, but this is sort of showing you there is some correlation there more than you would think, especially with value stocks and especially with people. People are taking money out of bonds, right? Because they want, like I said, want to clip the coupon. So they're either investing in real estate or they're investing in these stocks that they could clip the coupon for, right? High-paying dividend stocks. So they're trying to think of those stocks as, and you'll see a lot of active managers tell you, this company is not worth that. But people are buying it at that level just because they want that income. They want that coupon. They want that dividend in the mail. And they're paying way too much for it up front, according to what sort of the experts say it's valued at. And that's pushing the value up to the stock. Not for the fundamentals of the company, but because of the demand, because they can't get it in bonds. If a 10-year bond's only giving me 2%, but I could get 4 or 5 from this stock that they'll send me a dividend in the mail, and they're not...
It's irrational exuberance once again. I think we had a bubble or something one time.
Right. So, So that's some of the stuff that's going on with the economy there. Page 24, we just go over, this is part of your guidelines. You know, you have guidelines for how you manage the pension fund as good stewards should. And so page 24, just on the left-hand side are your targets. On the right-hand side is where you are. So in the large cap equity space, you have Wellington and Wedge managing that money. You're a little bit over-allocated there, not on purpose, but because those markets are doing better than some of the other ones. You have SBH, Siegel, Bryant, Hamill. In his presentation, I noticed he used a lot of acronyms. I try not to do that, but if you do catch me saying NCREIF, which maybe some of you didn't know, NCREIF is just the benchmark for real estate that's used. But our industry's full of jargon that people throw around and forget that they're doing it. You're over-allocated a little bit there too, but you know, not outside your range. And then international equity are a little bit over-allocated there. Those are the sectors of the market that have been doing better than bonds. So if you look at the bond side on fixed income, your target's 32, you're at 29. So again, not outside your range, but you could just see which parts of the portfolio have done better. If that gets way outside, if you get outside your range, then we do rebalance. We take some money off the table in the equity markets and put it in the bond market. But you're not to that point yet. And then real estate. So when he came in and talked, so you can see UBS here is 5.83% of your real estate portfolio. The rest of these are value-add real estate. So, you know, he said, oh, you could go into our value-add fund. Well, you already do that sort of on your own, right? You have half of your real estate with him, which is a core fund, and then you have half of your real estate with value-add and opportunistic real estate. And you just hired that Westport fund with a target of $4 million. They haven't called any money yet, but you just hired them. The contract's been completed to give more money to that part of real estate because we knew 4 or 5 years ago that core real estate wasn't going to do as well as value add, and so you've been sort of diversifying your bucket there. And so you're at 11.38% with the new allocation to Westport. That should start to increase that there. And then you have alternatives. You hired hedge funds and GTAA because, again, we knew were indicators that bonds weren't going to do as well. So you took money out of the bond market and you put it in hedge funds and GTA to try to get a better return there. And we could see what those returns are. But you're a little bit under target there, but nothing major. And then your total market value as of 9/30 is $141,295,642. This box on the left was Bernie sort of wanted this added to really track where you were on a funded basis and to have that in your investment report, so we added that. Now I take Doug's number as of whatever the last valuation was, and then I use the most recent market value. So from a quarter basis, you could say, oh, okay, Rose, our market value went up or down, how'd our funded ratio change? And so when I get the new evaluation, when Doug does the new one, which should be coming in the next couple months, I'll change the denominator there, and you'll get to see that based on the new liability projections he does. So then we'll move just to page 29. And these are your total fund returns for the quarter. I mean, you had a very strong quarter, up 3.35%, year to date 10.94%. 1 year, 11%. So you could see across the board, you've done well. You continue to do well. Wedge Capital has outperformed over all periods there. One of my pages here. So Wedge has done well. Wellington did well for the quarter, but they underperforming over the periods, and we brought them in to talk to them. You know, it's been a tough place for active management, so that's just something that we've been talking about for a while. And Siegel, Bryant, Hamill also had a tough quarter there. They consumer discretionary financials and, you know, some commodity-linked stocks there were hinderers for them. Templeton's been doing well. It's hard to see with both indexes there. They have some emerging markets in there. So when emerging markets do really well, they don't have as much emerging markets as that second benchmark, but they do have some. So just to compare them to the EFI isn't fair either. So that's why we put both benchmarks. Since inception, they've outperformed. And if you look at the five-year, They didn't outperform the EFI, but they did outperform the ACWI, and they've been a strong international manager for you. Acadian, you know, they came out of the gate, we weren't really sure what was going to happen there, and if you look since inception, I mean, almost 3%, 2-3% above the benchmark. Great manager's done very well for you. Pyramus outperforming over all periods. Double I outperforming over all periods. UBS, you could see that underperformance. That's why we brought them in. If you were to look at like a blend of UBS and then your other managers, like on the five-year basis, your real estate managers, the other ones have done 14%. So if you took the 9.5 and the 14, you're going to be above that 11.6 half and half. You know, we don't do that there, but they're more conservative. The Odyssey has, we wrote a memo up, and I don't know if it got distributed, so I should have probably brought some to pass out, but we had a real estate group do a deep dive into UBS. I mean, they do that regularly, but specifically for you, because we had concerns about them at the last meeting. And they really see them as a very solid core manager, but the Odyssey has 40% leverage. And they have 20% leverage. Max is 20%. They're actually at 19. So really comparing them to Odyssey in a market where leverage is so helpful to you. Over the long run, you can look, they've outperformed on the 10-year and on since inception. But in a market where leverage is going to be so helpful to you and they can't even go up to the 40%, that's why you're going to see that underperformance. So I don't have an issue with them. I think they're still a really good, solid manager for your portfolio. And we could talk more about that if you'd like. Wellington does well. You know, we fired PIMCO, who didn't do so well in that space, and I think Wellington was a great hire for you. I actually saw them present at Cape Coral a couple months ago. You know, they're just doing some great stuff over there, and they've done well for you. Atos, they lowered their fee again, which is good. So we got another reduction in fee because they're seeing a lot of people take money out of Atos and move it into Wellington. And you did that last meeting. You decided to take a little bit of money out of them and reallocate it because you want a balance between Atos and Wellington, you know, to have a good balance there. But they've done well. If you actually look at the five-year return for Atos at 5.5, and then you look at the five-year return for Pyramus, who outperformed their benchmark at 3.45. That's really why we did hire hedge funds, right? We wanted an offset to fixed income. We knew fixed income wasn't going to do as well. Yeah, we hoped that the T-bill plus 5 might be more than 5.5%, but that's not how the market sort of went in the last 5 years. So they really did do what they asked. If we looked at that maybe a year or two ago, that number wouldn't have been that way. But they've made up a lot of ground, and I think they're still additive to your portfolio. And then you have your cash accounts here, so no issues there. And then if you flip to page 31, you'll just see the private real estate. So these are your other real estate managers. And you can see we like to look at the IRR since inception, which is 10.95. So all those managers have done a really good job for you. Longmore 5 is just too new. They just started out. So we expect a little bit of what we call the J curve, which is where, you know, they're drawing down money, buying properties, they haven't had time to fix them up, so the valuation's a little bit lower. But overall, that's your portfolio. I don't have any recommendations for changes or rebalancing or anything like that. I like where you are. I think your managers are doing well, given maybe, you know, a challenging market. Do you have any questions?
No, the biggest thing I've been looking at lately is just making sure payroll's being met without drawing any money down. So we seem to be okay so far, but we don't have many more people that have huge accumulated amounts in the drop. I think most of them are finally starting to leave. I mean, we have more people starting to go in the drop, but just so you know, I mean, I question them all the time to make sure that we are still in the positive. That's the biggest thing I look at. Whenever I see Alicia ask for cash, it's like I get concerned about that.
Right. You know, and I didn't highlight page 26. I should have. Your fiscal is important. That's the number Doug's going to ask for. You know, the 10.68 versus the benchmark of 10.24. You did outperform for your fiscal period to have a 10% fiscal return, probably not what we predicted, you know, a year ago. But that's great. I mean, it'll help your funding. It'll help the stuff that Doug does to have some, you know, gains there versus what the return was. So that's a good number.
Lee, on to you. Anything new and exciting?
Well, I want to follow up by a piece of new legislation that we mentioned previously and was adopted. And I just want to follow up on that because part of it, we had some things we had to do. But it was Senate Bill 80 when it was going through the legislative session. And it was an amendment to Chapter 119 on public records. And primarily the two things that it did was number one, it provides that if an attorney wrongly files a civil suit, public records, he will not be entitled, or she will not be entitled to attorney fees or costs any longer, which I think it's a good thing because that was being abused. So that was a good piece of legislation. Yeah, they didn't do anything in this session to hurt us. So unlike the last prior couple of years. The other item, and this is where we have a couple of things to do if we haven't, under that bill, we must post a notice on the board of the building where business was mostly done that identifies that is the place, number one, and number two, the name of the person that needs to be contacted to get the public records and how to do that.
Yeah, we do that.
Okay.
And we did that pre the bill going in.
Okay. And also, do you have it on your website? Okay. We're all set.
We were already doing this. So.
Okay, yes.
You're ahead of the game, huh?
Okay, so I have a couple of things. The first thing that we were talking about and kind of reached out to you, and now we need some better direction. I want to know if employees can pre-select, if they drop dead today, their spouse only gets 10 years, but can they pre-select and then at time of retirement make a correction, or if there's a divorce or something, they can change that?
I think I had a conversation about that and checked the plan. I'll check the plan. That's what we're talking about is pre-retirement death benefit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think an employee should have the right to predetermine. I mean, obviously, you know, you plan on continuing working through your whole career, but I mean, like, if you wanted to pre-designate,
yeah,
I don't see why they can't.
Well, it's governed by the ordinance, so I'll check it. If they can't do it currently, we can propose an amendment to the ordinance.
So I'd like to approach that for the, you know, for the employees. I don't think it hurts the plan much, but, you know, it's for the employee. I mean, I always thought about that myself as an employee, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, if I were to drop dead, my wife only gets 10 years, and obviously Social Security, but what if I really wanted to give her for life, her life?
Right.
You know, I don't have that opportunity until the day I retire, and I don't think that's right.
I'll check the plan, and also Doug would have to have some input on whether there would be any additional funding required, and then the board can decide whether to ask.
I mean, it would have a funding impact because if everyone suddenly chose they wanted payments for life for all their
spouses yeah.
instead of the 10-year certain, that's the default, I guess, setting.
Understood, but, you know, it's...
And an already very expensive 105% of payroll plan.
So that's what you want for pre-retirement, that's to go from life and 10-year certain to life.
Right.
As the default or just as an option to pre-select?
I think it's an option to pre-select. I mean, you know, you have some single people and it wouldn't make a difference to them, but I think some people that are married, I mean, you know, and I don't know if they even think that stuff out. It's just like we have to remind people when they get divorced, you know, it's like you need to change your beneficiary, you know, it's like, unless you want to keep it that way, but, you know, it's like sometimes people don't think that out, you know, it's...
Well, under the law now, if you want to keep your same beneficiary and get divorced, and you want to keep it after the divorce, you have to execute a new designation. So I'll check that, and would you like me to go ahead and get a cost and dog, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I'm even thinking, you know, if there's a huge cost, maybe push it on to that employee if that's what they want to do. I mean, but we got to have the numbers to even talk about it, but.
Okay, so we'll make life an option that can be chosen, and I get a cost study from Dunbar.
Right.
Okay.
And then we'll ask council if they're interested in making that change.
Well, yeah, you follow what I'm saying, Cindy. I mean, you know, it's like.
That sounds like a benefit enhancement to me, so we'll have to ask.
Well, and I think I posted that way, you know, if there is a cost, I mean, you know, and once we have those numbers, I mean, we could present that to council and the employees that, you know, if you want that.
If they're interested.
Right.
I mean, you know, and how many people would elect it? I mean, it just, you know, it's, we're down to what, 200 people in the plan even? That are even still in the plan. That number shrinks every year.
Sure.
So.
Kind of look at it as an additional life insurance policy. I mean, you know, if they want it, they're going to pay for it, but.
You're right, a lot of people fail to plan, but at some point, you know I've said this before, like, let's be grownups and have some personal responsibility, and, like, it's not our job to take care of everybody's eventuality. If you're concerned about 10 years not being enough, there's lots of life insurance options for you to purchase. There's IRAs, there's all kinds of ways you could be saving for that eventuality. I mean, we keep walking that tightrope of over taking care of our employees as if their unwillingness to take care of themselves. You know, we talk about the millennials being entitled. Well, we're treating our employees like they're a bunch of millennials who can't make a decision. And I mean, like my husband died 2 months and 4 days ago. I didn't ask the city to take care of me.
No.
We planned. I mean, we didn't expect him to die at 42. Kind of sucks. But it's not the city's responsibility whether I and my husband made those arrangements or not. And so I'm not real sympathetic to people not taking care of what they need to take care of as responsible adults and looking to their employer for safety net. I mean,
I'm just curious. I mean, I don't think I ever attended any of the new employee orientation, but I'm wondering if things like that are mentioned to them.
They are. I attend it every month when it's held, and Adam Hunt is there, and he goes over every option that they have. We go over all their insurance options, the additional ones. Yes. Of course, and those people are entering the 401A anyway.
Yeah.
They're not in the pension plan. Right. So Adam does go over IRAs and Roths and 457 and all the other options that you have. But I don't know. I just think we're getting so far away from personal responsibility. You know, in corporate America, I mean, your employer is not going, let me hold your hand and do all of this for you. Sometimes I feel like it's insulting to the employees the way we talk about them as if they're inept and incapable of taking care of themselves. And if they are,
Cindy.
But I don't understand how that becomes the taxpayers of Ocala's problem.
Well, I think a lot of governments take a view. A parental role more than a corporate employer would, because of the fact that if you don't take care of it on the front end, it's going to be the city's problem one way or the other, right? So well, if the people are homeless, if the people need services, if the people don't do it and don't do the so a city typically ends up taking more of a parental role than a corporate employer would, because at the end of the day, I guess you sort of, as a city, end up, at least the cities I work with, you know, they feel like they're gonna end up one way or the other. They're gonna get it. They're gonna have to, you know, deal out the cash sort of one way or the other.
The way to do that is to provide them options, and the city provides a lot of options. If the employee chooses to not take those options, we can't continue to fund for them, because either way, it's not enough. I mean, there, you know, you have to come from them at some point and take care of your business. So I just, you know, it's a fine line. And yes, I understand at the end of the day, you know, if your Social Security isn't enough and whatever pension you collected isn't enough and now you're struggling, I still have to say, like you don't have to become a statistic. You can, like, bootstrap it. Do what needs to be done while you're able. I'm just... You can tell I'm very fiscally conservative, I guess.
Tell us how you feel.
Good. But, I mean, I'm not saying it's not worth a look, but that's... But I always want to be careful when we walk that tightrope.
Sure.
Because then we're also not providing that for the other 800 employees in the city who are in a 401A. There's no safety net for those employees. So then we are creating classes of employees.
I think we already have.
Yeah, well, the divide will grow if we continue to coddle those that already have, in my opinion, a very generous.
No, I'm not disagreeing. Yeah. I'm in that group and I'm excited, you know, but I have planned from, you know, my future and my demise, you know. Yeah. But, minutes? You read them? Motion to accept?
Motion to accept minutes.
One is four. Okay. The ranking Foster and Foster gave us. I guess you can just review that if you want. If there's any questions. So, Jessica, you have trustee appointees. Does that mean that these three people, myself, Johnny, and Bernie, is all expired? And
yes, I can't remember the exact date. Y'all are coming up in 18, I think, the next couple of months.
So how does that work, Lee, since Bernie and Johnny are appointed by city council, right? So if they don't want to visit it, we just have an automatic renewal?
They would have
to
that seat would have to be filled by a council appointment.
They're not automatically reappointed. They would have to redo their application and say, I want to seek another term. And if nobody else applies, then I recommend we appoint them because nobody else applied. If somebody else applies, we interview all of the candidates. And then I make a recommendation of the candidates that apply to the council. You know,
right.
We talk to these three people. We recommend this or that person. They can vote any way they want and appoint whoever they want of that bunch, but they want the PSL to fill out the new application for the new term.
When do they expire?
I don't have the dates.
So let's see. Bernie expires on February 18th. Johnny, February 22nd on both. John and Bernie and me is also 2/28/18.
Okay. Well, you can all be appointed for the next meetings that we have scheduled. If for some reason that doesn't occur, you can continue to serve. There's something in Florida called the holdover principle, and if a seat isn't filled after it expires, the individual can continue. That's been my case law since 1902.
And yours is the
also
elected.
February 22nd. I'm elected by the employees and appointed by council.
Well, they ratify the
right.
Election, so we'll have to. I mean, and I think Alicia is planning to do the send out yours and the employee vote or whatever. And then the others, we can send out the clerk sends it or Alicia does for reappointment.
And then we have from Lee's office next year's meetings. Has everybody kind of looked at them?
It's the same pattern that we had for many years.
And you should be a little more accessible, huh?
Oh, I'm back. Yeah, I had a tough time there for a while. It was an ordeal, but... 100% again, yep. Oh, yeah, let me see, you know, and Alicia and I talked, but you can call me anytime on the cell phone. Travel up, always have the cell phone and try to get back quickly.
Well, since you mentioned it, critiquing is, you know, Alicia once or twice had problems with you, and I said, hey, I call him and he replies right away and then get things going. So hence the whole thing that we're trying to, and that's up here. I have a performance evaluation report that we want to start critiquing all of our, you know, so we've had some problems with Doug, and I've let him know, but he still uses the same excuse, and he blames Alicia for not getting information, and she gets him the information when he asks for it. He still uses the whole thing of the variable rate defined benefit as an excuse to delay giving us information. I say it's unacceptable. He's had enough years and his algorithm is now solid.
The first year I bought it.
Right.
It's new. We were all like, what? We can't do it this nonsense. And we finally figured out a calculation and it's the same calc every year.
And Lee, I mean, we've had a few things with you. I mean, I still have heartburn with your guaranteed, you know, cost of living increases every year. I still have problems with that, you know, nobody else we have is guaranteed 4% every year. You know, it's... And I have problems with that, personally. And I'm bringing it up in front of the board, too, that, you know, it's... When you brought it to the board, I was the only one opposed it, and I didn't get enough board to buy in. But I still have heartburn about it. I think a performance evaluation report should justify if you get, you know, a raise or not. I don't think it should be automatically implemented. Just sharing that with you.
When are you going to require the board to return their evaluations to?
So I wanted everybody to look at it.
Well, let me say, I didn't realize there was a timing problem sometimes with Alicia and I. May have been when I was sick, but the best way to get me as quickly as possible is to call me on my cell phone. Because sometimes I don't see the emails until sometime hence.
With
you,
Alicia? Oh,
she's not here.
No, Alicia's not here. Oh, I thought somebody talked to her, but
Alicia's
I don't know
who's
on the inside of that wall there.
So I've been kind of working with Jessica. With Alicia a little bit overseeing coming up with these evaluation reports, just so we, I think we owe it to the pension board, you know, and to the pension itself to look at these. Like I said, I mean, Doug does not produce stuff in a timely manner, and that becomes some heartburn to us because then we have to have special meetings just to meet when he's ready to give his report finally, and. We have predetermined meetings. He should be able to meet those predetermined meetings, and I will tell him the same thing. I mean, and just like, you know, Rose performs everything that we want, but she's been with the board since inception, and I think that, you know, due diligence is that we at least rate people and decide if we should go out and... I still wonder with you, Lee, I mean, you know, eventually... Sad to say, but, you know, there is that mortality rate. Eventually, you get to the point where, you know, can you perform or can't you? And what is your progression plan? I mean, what do we do? We've been using you since inception. I mean, there's been some bumps here and there, but what do we do as you get older, as your health fails? I mean, we experienced a little bit of that, and it's like, what do we do in that case? I mean,
hopefully, I'm not anywhere near that yet, but Scott and I, well, I sent you a letter.
Right.
Scott and I decided we wanted to cut back on our travel. That found it wasn't as resilient as it used to be, and the cut out the plans that we transitioned were in the Panhandle, the Jacksonville area, and some down the East Coast. And the goal of that was to, again, reduce the travel. And so we sent letters to who we're keeping. I hope that's good news. And we sent letters to the ones that are being transitioned. And that, about, the plans that are going are about 50, and we'll end up still with a few, a little bit over 100. So just that, we did, we spent a lot of hours getting places, and so I think it's, it was a good move. I always said I didn't want to retire entirely, and I don't.
No, so you're doing like some of my friends that say they're kind of partially retired. They just keep the jobs they want. Toss all the others to the curb.
Well, it sounds harsh, but I guess you can put it that way. That's what it ends up. But the reason is that there was no individual problem with any boards. It was strictly the travel.
Jessica, you have something here that says February meeting.
That's for the expenses. That's going to be moved to the February meeting because Wells Fargo's stuff just came in. So everything's going to change. So she just figured she'll do it February. I'll conclude it now.
All right. So Alicia is asking us to kick in towards a laptop for the pension board. For the pension, you know, admins up there, so she can take a laptop home when she deals with her husband at times, because, you know, she's got FMLA for him, and she'd still like to produce, and of course, you know, using a personal laptop or personal computer with us, we kind of understand that they can't. So I think fire and police have already, it's $362.87. I can't make a motion to spend the money, but somebody can, and I can second it for sure, but... Anybody have a problem with spending $362? Give Alicia a little...
No, I'll make a motion.
All right, I'll second it. Everybody for it?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, good deal. What am I missing, Jessica? Oh, upcoming events. So, Anthony signed up for January. John, I know we've kind of mentioned that, you know, you have to continue your education.
Yep, so I went this year.
Okay, good deal.
Right, so for next year, I don't know what I'm going to do.
All right. Yeah. Wait, well, you know, there's several options out there, but we try to get everybody to just go out there and see what's going on and experience.
Yeah, I went this year to Orlando.
Did you find it... an experience at all? I mean, did you learn anything?
Absolutely.
You gained something?
Yeah, absolutely. I figured that I don't want to get certified.
Right.
But I went to all of them. I learned. Yeah.
So I did the same thing. I don't want to get certified. I don't think I need to be certified, but I keep myself well-rounded. I mean, I go to a bunch of meetings every year just so I can stay on top of what's going on. Whenever you feel I'm not being diligent at that, as a board, you need to mention that to me, and I would be happy to step down, but I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to for the plan. Jessica, you keep on going to your meetings too, right? You have to stay certified.
I'm not yet.
Did you test?
No, I didn't. I'm not. I was talking to Alicia. I probably will test next year. I wanted to get a little bit more comfortable.
You notice I'm doing this on purpose in front of the board, right? I've already warned you.
And we have a backup, Sadie Smith in my office, in the budget office.
Uh-huh.
It's pension certified. We just got her certified this year. So
okay, cool.
That way, if succession planning...
Well, we know Alicia's, you know... Her tentative date is coming up sooner than, you know, it's...
Yeah, I had Sadie get certified that way. You know, if during the transition, if Jess needs help, we have someone on the city side who's certified and can step in and help out.
I keep telling everyone to 2.5 years I plan on leaving too, you know, it's, which means Jessica has to come up to speed quickly. If Alicia's leaving in two or less, I'm in 2.5, whereas I tell everybody, one bad meeting.
Alicia's still working now, right?
Yeah, she's upstairs with the other meeting up there, but...
Jessica, would you tell Alicia if I don't see her today, when she keeps to get me the quickest, is call my cell phone?
Okay.
And you as well, can you call? Arnie, same thing.
Well, I have your number, I know how to get ahold of you, I mean, unless you're definitely sick, you know, I won't bother you, but otherwise, I don't have...
I have your cell phone too, Lee. We all got it.
No wonder I have to replace those things so often.
I think I've covered everything. Does anybody have anything for...
I do. We adopted the changes to the general pension ordinance at the last city council meeting, so those are effective now. The legislative session was moved up this year. It's an early session, so we've been in committee meetings since September 12th. The actual session will start January 9th, so there's just over 1,000 bills already been filed. So I'll be watching, you know, the pension bills or any other bill that may affect, you know, the pension plans as
yeah, January 9th to March.
Yeah.
And you have time to read books too, huh?
Yeah. Well, most of my books are in the form of ordinances and bills right now.
That's what I'm thinking.
So we're watching. I don't see anything yet that will affect the general plan. Some of the final stuff may come back. They've tried a couple of times to make some amendments to those statutes, but nothing so far has been filed that affects the general plan. But we'll certainly end.
Is there any talk with the union or anything? Pension. Have you heard anything?
The union had the option to open pension negotiations in January of 17. They have yet to raise their hand and do so. You know, they're only, you know, we've heard that they just want to put the old plan back, and we've told them that that's a non-starter.
Right.
So unless you have something other than that, you know, so we haven't heard.
Well, I've told some of these union guys, look at what they offer you for their pension plan. It's like, it is nowhere near.
Right. There, and they've asked, the last set of negotiations, they asked for the IBEW's pension plan, which we showed was paltry. It was a fraction of what they get in their current plan. So I was like, why would you want that? So then they wanted that and what they have and for the city to pay for all of it. So that's not going to happen.
Right.
So you got any other ideas? So, you know, they really haven't come forth with a viable plan that would be, you know, cost effective and beneficial in any way. And then, you know, the other part is their membership, again, is very striated. They have 400-ish bargaining unit members, of which not many paying, in the not even 100 paying dues. But they're not all in the pension plan, is the other thing. So the majority of them are in the 401A. So they're like, well, we don't need you bargaining that for us. We want wages or, you know, other PTO changes or other things. Because there's 40-ish in the pension plan. So, you know, it's for the majority of the membership, it's not really their focus. We've had no letter filed saying, hey, let's do it, let's talk about it. The contract comes up soon, so we'll just talk about it, I guess, when the contract expires. But we don't see, my current council direction is still hold, you know, don't change anything. And, you know, the plan is starting to improve, performance is, you know, looking well, so, you know, level dollar funding is helpful. That percentage sounds scary, but level dollar funding wise, we're okay. But I don't anticipate any different direction from council on pension, unless something dramatically changes.
Cindy, you mentioned ordinance passes. Is it our ordinance?
Yes, our
ending that passed.
Yep.
Great.
Yep, that's awesome.
And that having passed now, I haven't been done taking a look at the summary plan description.
Yes.
Which has been on hold too, because I was waiting for that ordinance to pass.
Yep, somewhere. Yeah, it's effective last week, I think.
Great.
Yes, now we can update some of my instruction, or adopt it.
Right.
Because I think you already put the edits in pending the passage of the new ordinance.
Yep.
So that's all, I think that's all I have.
Cool.
And I think that I've told Alicia, but I don't know, Jessica knows too, I think she does, but just to mention this, you have $775,000 in cash as of September, I don't know what that balance is, October. Yeah, end of October, but if you do build up cash, let us know and we'll invest that. It does look like you're cash flow positive, which in the past you've been cash flow negative. So year to date from January to September, you've been in the positive. So when that happens, a plan that's used to being in the negative, you may start to accumulate cash and not know that. So if you just sort of be aware of that, and if you know, like, you sort of know what's outstanding, right? But like if you get to a point, you know, that you're holding more than 2 or 3 months in cash,
right,
we should invest it. Mm-hmm. If it's 2 or 3 months, then that's fine. But if it's more than that, you're not going to need that cash, then tell me, you know, hey, we got $1 million or $500,000 and we'll get it, we'll at least get it invested for you. Because the more that it's invested, you know.
Yeah. More invested than we are sitting in the bank. Right. Sure.
So just, you know, just let my office, let us know and we'll recommend where for your asset allocation that money would be invested. So.
Jessica, I'll just ask you, and are our money managers producing their financials as we ask for them? I know it's been a problem and that's something else that I want to also beat up on too, that, you know, it's... I think it's really important that, you know, we make sure that we have everything necessary to give to the actuary, and I know that's been another side excuse too, but
yeah, but if you have all their data from us by November, so I never, like, there's, we can always tell when they've started to work on the plan.
Yeah, all of a sudden.
Because all of a sudden the questions come fast and furious.
Right.
So I give you data in November and it's like radio silence until February when I'm jumping all of you saying like, I can't put my audio out till I have a number.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, well, we need this and we need that and we need this. Well, how come you didn't look at my data in November and ask me for what you needed? Because if there are certain pieces you're missing or you need more clarification on, you haven't looked at it. It's been sitting.
And even like a private, you don't have any private equity, but you've got private real estate, and they take a little bit longer, but
work on what you have.
But at the end of November, 60 days,
right,
they'll have it to you. Right. So if they're not until February, I don't know what's happening now, because you're gonna have all that.
Well, they'll
data,
say, but, oh, we were waiting for all of the data before we started working on it, and I'm like, okay, well, there's lots of stuff you can work on and plug in some numbers as you go. I mean, I'm putting out a finance statement for a city that's $1 billion. I mean, trust me, I work on what I can and I plug in what's missing as I go.
So if you are getting any issues with managers, let me know. Just go let me know and I'll make sure that they get you their data.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's past November typically. I don't think so. And usually that's about when we have everything, so.
Just kind of want to bring these guys up to speed in the meeting, but you know, it's, just so you're aware of all the other little parts and pieces going on. Well, with that being said, motion to adjourn.
Second.
All right. Good deal.
I can't believe it's that time to say happy Thanksgiving.